Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of November. This hour, I don't know if you saw this marvelous op-ed piece in the New York Times on Sunday. It's written by Susan Engel, who's our guest this hour, and she has a cry to everybody to teach our teachers well. Actually, that's the title of the piece. Our best universities, she writes, have paradoxically typically looked down their noses at education as if it were intellectually inferior. The result is that the strongest students are often in colleges that have no interest in education, while the most inspiring professors aren't working with students who want to teach. So weaker students are in less intellectually rigorous programs are the ones preparing to become teachers. First thing we need to do, she says, is to get the best colleges to throw themselves into the fray. And she has many other suggestions in her piece. On this day that President Obama is visiting Madison, we thought that it was a good day just to look at education. He's going to be talking about education reform at Wright Middle School in Madison this afternoon. So let's look at reforming the way we teach teachers this hour. I know we're going to have a lot of response. Susan is a senior lecturer in psychology and director of the program in teaching at Williams College. She's also taught at Berkshire Community College, Bennington College, and Smith College, has taught all ages from 3 years to graduate students. 13 years ago, co-founded an experimental school in the eastern end of Long Island, New York, where she has supervised the faculty and developed curriculum. She has written 3 books, The Stories Children Tell. She has written Context is Everything, The Nature of Memory, Real Kids. She's currently writing a book called Red Flags or Red Herrings, which is about what we can and can't predict about children's lives. And her current research is on, I love this one, the development of curiosity. She has 3 sons, and we're going to be welcoming phone calls for her. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Hello, Susan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, great to have you here. Your article just really stood out. I just read it and thought, oh, we got to have her on the air.
Oh, thank you so much.
It really is wonderful because somebody's devoting, and you have a big cry for changing the way that we prepare people for the most important job in the country almost.
Yep, I agree.
It is just a huge job. Why is it that our best universities have looked down their noses at education?
You know, I don't know historically what explains that. I think very often, in the past, I think we thought teaching was an easy thing, and that's the history of teachers from a long time ago in this country, that it was something you could do if you weren't smart enough or ambitious enough to become a doctor or a lawyer or some, you know, high-level white-collar professional. And the assumption was that it was sort of like a trade that you could learn just the mechanics of, and you would be good at it. And there may have been a time when teaching well was easier to do, but now our country is incredibly ambitious when it comes to education. We want to educate a huge number of people from a wide variety of backgrounds, and they need to learn more than ever. I mean, there's so much information for students to learn and so many skills for them to acquire. So the task is daunting, and it may require a kind of educational preparation it didn't a long time ago. I don't know if that's the historical reason for it. I find it incredible that so many of our most brilliant professors in fields like mathematics, biology, history, have no interest in how their subject matter connects to teaching. They think they can leave that to somebody else. And to me, one of my missions in life is to persuade the most interesting people in those fields to get involved.
Right.
Now, you know, historically, people did that. Jerome Bruner, one of our greatest cognitive psychologists, wrote a book in 1959 called The Process of Education, based on a conference at Woods Hole where the best historians and social scientists gathered together to think about what good social studies could be in elementary and high school. But that was a long time ago, and brilliant thinkers like Jerry Bruner no longer concern themselves enough with education.
You talk about the first step is to get the best colleges to throw themselves into the fray,
yeah,
which is a really good idea. How the heck do you do it?
You know, I don't know. By writing a column, I guess. Here at Williams, I am very proud of what's happened. When I first started teaching here, which was almost 20 years ago, I was teaching developmental psychology. That's my field. That's what my doctorate's in. And a student sort of came to my door surreptitiously and kind of knocked and almost whispered and said, I've heard you love schools, that you know something about teaching. Yeah. Can you supervise me? Can you help me learn to be a teacher? And I said, sure, but why do you seem so hushed about it? She said, because when I've expressed this interest to other people here, they ask me why I bothered coming to Williams if all I wanted to do was teach.
Oh, my gosh.
So we, too, were guilty of that kind of snobbery. And now I'm proud of us. We have a program in teaching. We don't offer a graduate program, and that's a whole other issue. Who and where should the graduate programs be? But at least here at Williams, I have more and more people here. The most interesting students and the most interesting faculty members have gotten interested in this. So I don't know what it takes except to pull colleges in one at a time. And, you know, we're not the only one. Bowdoin has an interesting program. Sarah Lawrence has a wonderful program. There are other good colleges that do it, but it needs to be we need to make a much bigger commitment to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think one thing that didn't make it through in my column, but it was in the original version. If I were Bill Gates, which is what I originally wrote in that piece, I would not give so much money to fixing and changing individual schools. I would endow a few brand new, really exciting graduate programs.
Mm.
And I would draw the best faculty to those programs and then make it incredibly competitive so that the best students were vying for a place in those programs.
Yeah, you talk about having a 3.5 undergraduate grade point.
Yeah. I mean, the only way to change our view of teaching and to attract great people is to make it competitive and make it worthwhile. So it has to be a funded program. And to me, the people who want to change who have money to give, should not be giving it to individual schools. They should be giving it to change the way we prepare teachers.
And we prepare them. This would be a change as well. You're preparing them to teach at the graduate level?
What do you mean?
So you're preparing students that you have to have a 3.5 undergraduate.
And then they have to go to graduate
study.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, and anybody who has kids knows this, you want your kids to be around well-educated people. You want their teachers to be people who took great undergraduate courses. I mean, you know, I have a strong bias, obviously, towards a liberal arts education. I teach at a liberal arts institution. I think that the best teachers themselves had a wonderful undergraduate experience, but that's not enough. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. Then they need to begin learning how you use your knowledge, your excitement about learning, your awareness of novels, of history, of math, of whatever it is. You need to learn how to teach that to others, how to incite that kind of interest in your students. You know, I always say, I use the model in the column, medical school. A lot of medical schools love to get students with an undergraduate degree from a liberal arts college. They know that in the long run makes for good doctors. But then they think they need to go to medical school and learn the tools of their trade. And that's what I think is required to become a great teacher. So I would never want to cut off the liberal arts piece of it. I think you need that, and then you need to learn more.
Yeah. You also talk about teachers need to learn far more about children.
Oh, yeah. So I'm a developmental psychologist, and I know from all my years of reading research, of observing kids, of trying to think well about what they're doing and why, that it's a really complex matter. It's not obvious why the 7-year-old flings himself down on the floor, or why the 12-year-old can't seem to get interested in any academic topic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not obvious why it's completely futile to try to cram too much information into the mind of a 7-year-old. And this is a whole other issue that I'm interested in. It seems to me that the way that we've structured elementary and high school curriculum and teaching methods seems to fly in the face of everything we know about how children develop. I think the best teachers spend a good part of their time thinking about the kids in their classroom and what will really work with them, what they're really like, what their developmental needs are. And when you see a teacher who has that kind of knowledge, it's amazing. They're very successful. I watched a teacher in Hoboken a few years ago, teaching a fourth grade classroom, public school, crowded room, all kinds of kids, but he had a really good background in developmental psychology. And he was able to use that in the way he solved problems for those kids all the time. Most programs in ed, I'm sure I'm going to make somebody angry out there who works in an education program, but lots of education programs teach developmental psychology in a very perfunctory way.
Mm-hmm.
So the students come out with this sort of cookie-cutter idea, 3-year-olds are like this, 12-year-olds are like this, reading develops this way, and that's not really what developmental psychology is. It's a much more dynamic, rich, complex way of thinking about kids.
Mm-hmm. It's such a complicated field, teaching, isn't it? When you think about what you just said and then you throw in the components of different cultures and urban settings and rural settings and parents who may not have done very well themselves in school, it's just huge.
It's so huge. And, you know, I watch teachers a lot. I spend a lot of time in schools watching young teachers, seasoned teachers. When you, in fact, this is one of the reasons I got the idea of this medical analogy. When you watch a really good teacher teaching a whole group of kids well, the complexity of their task and the demands of that task, it's like watching someone doing brain surgery. That's how intense it is. And how, you know, a lot of research shows that teachers encounter something like 200 unexpected interchanges during the day.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it's enormous how much of the day is sort of volatile, complex, unexpected. So to deal with all of that and then do well, get kids to want to learn, get them to learn what you hope they learn, requires so many different kinds of skills. I mean, you just named them. And when you watch it being done right, you appreciate what it requires and what it calls for. And obviously, you know, there used to be this big debate. I've heard people talk about this all the time, that, you know, you can't teach someone to be a good teacher. They're born that way. Or anybody can be a good teacher if they, you know, learn the right things. Both of those are ridiculous. So, again, to use a medical analogy, to be a good surgeon, you have to be smart, and you have to have great hand-eye coordination, and you have to be really good at making quick decisions under pressure. But that's not enough. You also need to go to a good medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And so a good teacher needs certain talents that not everybody has. But even the most talented person, given the task of teaching as we now have it in our society, those talented people also need to learn things because it's such a big job.
Right. I love what you said about teachers who do it well and you being able to see them. We all know when we think about it, maybe a handful of teachers who really helped us develop our lives.
Yeah,
what a
absolutely.
Big thing to do.
Absolutely. I think most people, like when I teach my course on education here at Williams, and I ask the students to think about a teacher who's had a big impact on them, you can see as they think about it how vivid that memory is,
mm-hmm.
and how powerful an impact that person had on them. Unfortunately, bad teachers also can have a big impact on kids.
Right.
By stifling them, by ignoring them, by being mean to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the truth is there's a vast middle ground. There are sort of teachers who aren't terrible, but they're not wonderful. One person wrote into the Times today suggesting, you know, that my vision is utopian. That may be, but it seems shocking to me that in such a highly developed society we would accept such a large number of mediocre classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
And in my view, you can test all you want, you can punish bad teachers all you want, but that won't change. If you don't give them the tools they need to be good, it's just a waste.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Susan. Susan Engel is our guest. She is a developmental psychologist, senior lecturer in psychology, and director of the program in teaching at Williams College. She's taught at other colleges, and she has taught all ages, co-founded an experimental school in the eastern end of Long Island, where she supervised the faculty and developed curriculum. She's written a number of books. Current research, I love this one, we'll have to ask her about it, The Development of Curiosity. And also, she's writing a book called Red Flags or Red Herrings, What We Can and Can't Predict About Children's Lives. She has I highly recommend you read this op-ed. It's in Sunday's New York Times, Teach Your Teachers Well, in which she calls for substantial changes to the way that we teach teachers. And I don't think that this audience, most of you, would disagree that it's one of the most honorable and most difficult of professions. Are we giving it all that it needs? Are we giving our children all that they need? Actually, it's in the Monday New York Times. I'm directing you the wrong place. Monday New York Times op-ed. Here's our phone number. Join us, please. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. A couple lines are open for you to speak with Dr. Susan Engel. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls, starting with Kathy from Green Bay. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes. I have a background in some of the education. My husband taught for 28 years, and the notion that we need the brightest of the brightest to teach in our professors and as our teachers, some of that is wrong because my husband, when he went to, and this does back up some of the guest said, he had professors there that were teaching above their heads. They were so smart. But my husband was going to teach first grade to sixth grade, and they were teaching as college. And he would brag about, well, how many would drop out. Well, yes, my husband dropped out because he could not take the classes. So then he went to the Outagamie Teachers College, two-year teacher college, and I went to Algoma, Kewanee Algoma Teachers College, year, and I'll tell you, they really taught you how to teach. My husband went into teaching, and when the state changed the qualifications, you had to have the 4 years, then he went to Oshkosh to finish. But my husband was a really good teacher. He wasn't the smartest, but he had the aptitude. There's a difference between brains and having the ability to teach somebody.
Well, hi. Nice to meet you, and I'm glad you called. You know, I think one of the problems in most discussions about education is we get pushed into an either-or. I totally agree with you. Being very smart and knowing lots about your topic is not enough. And there are plenty of people, I mean, we see them here at the college level, who are brilliant in their field of research but aren't good at communicating their knowledge to others. Those people are no more qualified to be teachers than students who don't know their material. It's not either or. That's the challenge ahead of us, that the group of people who are able to be teachers need to be both. Now, you know, I don't know your husband, and I believe that there are lots of great teachers who weren't the top of their class, who weren't the most brilliant. But when we think about the large picture, we need a lot of smart people in the world of teaching. After all, your job is to help students learn to use their minds. So one has to be good at using your own mind if you're going to help students do that. But I totally agree with you that it's not enough to be very knowledgeable about a topic. You also have to be good at sharing that knowledge with younger or less able students.
You spent some of the article talking about teachers needing to be happy to be there, to be at schools, which I think is crucial. And you come up with this very interesting idea of making sure they have good colleagues.
Yeah.
Please explain.
Well, I will. It's funny because I just got an email this morning from a really fabulous student of mine who graduated last year and went on to teach. And she talks about how isolated she feels this year and how hard that is for her. I'll give you an example. I went to visit a school in New York 2 years ago, a public school for the most at-risk kids. It was in one floor of a kind of decrepit building on the Lower East Side. You can't imagine a less auspicious setting for a school in terms of the challenges they were facing with those particular students, and the physical environment was kind of run down. It was a wonderful school. It happened to have a really great principal. And she created this feeling that the teachers were respected, they cared about one another, they had a lot to talk about with one another. There was this terrific feeling of camaraderie and professionalism. And they loved being there, those teachers. Even though they were working with difficult kids under difficult circumstances, the place was just buzzing with good feeling on their part, and then that affected the kids. And there was a good feeling amongst the students. I think collegiality is huge. one of the things that most teachers don't get to do once they start teaching is think about their teaching, try out new ideas, criticize one another in a supportive way, examine their teaching. You can't do that in a vacuum. You need other people going through it with you. And so one value of the proposal I put forth in the column is that if you put a bunch of very talented, bright, well-trained teachers together, they would support one another, not only by making each other feel good, but by helping each other explore their teaching and reflect on their teaching. I think one of the things that I didn't address in that column, but as another issue that I think is huge, when people talk about reforming schools, it's not just about the curriculum that you reform, nor is it just about the salary you pay teachers, though that's important. It's about making schools a wonderful work environment.
Sure.
We all know from our jobs, some places are good work environments and some aren't. But if you could, I happen to know a school here in Western Mass where, they're middle-of-the-road kids, and some of the teachers are great, and some are not so good, and they have the usual problems of any suburban high school. But the principal has created a wonderful atmosphere there where teachers have a chance to talk with one another, where it's safe to make mistakes, where it's encouraged that you try out new ideas. And you can tell when you walk into that building that teachers like to be there. And it's as simple as that. But if I were changing schools in this country, I'd put as much energy into that as I did into any assessment tool or particular curriculum plan.
Mm. Well, you need to hop on a plane and get to Madison, where the president is speaking this afternoon.
Yeah, I wish he would call right now. We could talk to him.
I wish he would, too. I hope he does call you. I hope that this gets to his attention when we're looking at reform, because it seems as though it's very crucial.
I think it's really important, and it's painful. I'm sure. I know I'm not alone in this. That many of us watch what's going on in education nationally and see certain really good ideas that just aren't being talked about, and lots of time and money being wasted on the wrong things. That's just hard to watch.
Kathy, thanks for your call. Bob is next from Minnesota. Hi, Bob.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to agree so much with what the speaker is saying, but I wanted to bring up a point that nobody talks about. I don't know if people are aware of it even. But once you become a teacher, you have your master's degree or bachelor's or whatever, and you're ready to go out into the field, college or teacher prep schools, schools of education, the placement offices in those places will tell you, and I've been at this for 40 years now, will tell you, okay, that's fine, but you better get your coach's certificate or you won't get a job, because that's what gets you a job in education and in K-12, especially 7 through 12 today in the United States.
So what are you suggesting? That's really interesting. What's your suggestion?
Well, my suggestion is that people who get their teaching jobs because of their coaching background, when they quit coaching after they get tenure, they also quit their job, and they go look somewhere else. I'm not sure what the answer is, but there's got to be an answer to the problem that we have in the United States that coaches are teachers. No other country on earth, and I've been in lots of them, has this system. And, they'll tell you that if you're a good teacher and a bad coach, you won't get a job. If you're a good coach and a bad teacher, you will get a job any day, especially in the Midwest if you coach hockey, basketball, baseball, and football. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it is. And I don't really have any, but no one speaks of this problem.
That's very interesting.
It is interesting.
I mean, I can't speak. I don't know what the statistics are in that, so I don't know how pervasive that is. I do think some great teachers are great coaches, and I have often noticed this here at Williams, that coaches are doing certain things that teachers could be doing too, that sometimes they can learn something from good coaching. If you ever watch a group of kids on a basketball court or a baseball field just working themselves into the ground to try to be good, you think, what could I do to get that same kind of energy and focus in the math room?
Exactly.
Or the reading room.
Exactly.
So I actually, this doesn't really address the the phone caller's issue, which is that they may be too tied to one another in certain schools' hiring practices. I don't doubt that, and that's a problem, because there are plenty of great teachers who aren't coaches. But I do think there's something to be learned from the best coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those places where more fertile talk and more fertile problem-solving within a school could make the most of those coaches in terms of sharing their insights with others.
Right. That's a very good point, because they obviously do have a set of skills. I have had a lot of experience with teenage boys, because we've had a lot
too.
Of teenage. Yeah, you too. And you know that if they've got a coach who really works with them, understands their skills, builds them up, helps them develop other skills, they are so loyal to that team.
Yeah.
You know, it gets them going in the morning, gets
Absolutely.
Them going to school and excited about school.
Absolutely.
It's crucial.
Absolutely. And there are places where the analogy breaks down. So a kid who just lives for basketball, of course they're going to practice hours and hours a day at boring things to be good because they want to win. And you can't. It's not always obvious what the analogy is in an academic setting, but it doesn't mean there aren't analogies. That requires rethinking how we structure curriculum, of course, but there are ways to do it so that kids could care as much about the fruit, the outcome of their labor in an academic setting, as they do about their athletics.
Oh, there's another book for you, Susan.
Yeah, I agree.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob, very much. Let's go next to Bill from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Okay. Quite frankly, I taught college for 2 years, and I think the measure of a good teacher is how many of their students learn and advance. That's the only measurement that I can see has any value. And quite frankly, I think our whole approach to education is wrong. We start with the premise that the teacher is all-knowing and the students are all ignorant, and therefore the teacher is going to lecture them or teach them or tell them. And I never did that. I reversed the process like the Chinese do. And I merely asked questions and turned my students' brains on. And then they created a love for interest in things and were challenged to seek the answers. And every one of my classes, all of my students received A's. And quite frankly, being at the college level, these were adults, and they went on to preeminent success in the world of business. So I really think that when someone's talking, their ego is flying, and the listener's ego is suffering, and it puts the kids to sleep. So if you ask questions and challenge them mentally, they rise to the occasion, and they get to talk, then their egos are flying, and then they create a love for learning.
Hmm.
Well, you know, I totally agree, and I think how wonderful that's the way you taught. I think plenty of good teachers teach that way. I think you're not alone. I think there are plenty of the other kind that you described, too, egomaniacs who get up there and just spout off. But I would say, looking around at my colleagues, you know, at the colleges where I've taught, there are plenty of people who feel it's their job to turn on the minds of their students, to ask questions, or to be... More and more, you know, I often feel in a class that we're doing it together. We're figuring something out together. I have certain kinds of knowledge, and they have certain kinds of insight and energy and new thoughts. And I think many teachers, even of elementary and high school classes, have the same feeling that they're fellow explorers. The question is, this goes back to the idea of teacher training. How can we help our young new teachers learn how to do that? There's a difference. In my experience watching teachers, there's a difference between the really knowledgeable teacher who is humble and encourages their students to inquire and the ignorant or less knowledgeable teacher who does that. That process looks different depending on whether the teacher actually has expertise. So in other words, you can have a lot of knowledge about your subject matter, and yet you act as a fellow explorer in the classroom, and that's the perfect combination, I think.
Thanks for calling. Let's talk about money for a moment, please, because obviously if you're going to have the best, the most motivated, and have them go to graduate school to become really fabulous teachers, that it seems to me as though teacher salaries are pretty low.
Absolutely.
And I'm also concerned about what it would take to have new teacher programs started at some of our most prestigious universities and many other universities. We're talking about an expensive proposition, are we not?
It's huge. But, you know, if you really believed, if I could convince anyone that this was the key to changing schools, it would be worth that kind of investment. I mean, I was thinking earlier before, you know, we talked, that I'd like to calculate how much has been spent on these standardized tests all over the country.
Right.
A huge
Billions.
Amount of money. If you had taken that money, I mean, talk about the tail wagging the dog. If you had taken that money and spent it, attracting talented, you know, promising young people into the field and then helping them get ready to teach, you'd get so much bang for your, you know,
right.
more bang for your buck. So it is very expensive, but so is having a country of failing schools. That's very expensive too. And it's not as if we don't have teacher ed programs. We have them. So the question is, how can we make them better? You know, in my fantasy world, the people with lots of money, like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, they wanted to give their money to make schools better. They have the money, and they gave it. The question is, are they giving it at the level where it's going to make the biggest difference? You can create model schools all you want, but until you fill them with teachers who are good at teaching, they won't succeed. And if you had great teachers, you wouldn't have to spend as much money reinventing curriculum all the time. And or, God knows, spending all this huge amount of money on assessment without figuring out how to help the kids learn the things you want to assess them on.
Bob from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I want to say that your guest's message should also be reaching the ears of parents who are soon to send children to college. Mm. Because I think what she's asking us to do, I think, is for parents to rethink, you know, what is an honorable, powerful profession. Mm. And we need to allow teaching to be in that list. As a parent who just saw his daughter graduate from the University of Wisconsin's mm-hmm. School of Ed and who's teaching her first group of students, we couldn't be more thrilled about what she's doing. But I think parents need to adjust their viewpoint so that they just don't see lawyers, doctors, and other traditionally high-power professionals as the only outlet for their children, and that teaching can be that very thing. So we need her message too as parents.
Is she happy teaching?
She's unbelievably happy, even with the challenges that all teachers have in terms of children coming to school with a lot of deficits.
Yeah.
One of the things that's made it really great for her this year is that the rest of the second grade teachers in this particular school go beyond their contract and meet twice a week in the morning before school to prepare as second grade teachers to do the best for their children. And that has been just extremely important for our daughter. She's a young teacher. She's still riding the high of a great education at the University of Wisconsin, and she's really thrilled to be doing what she's always wanted to do.
That's such a fabulous message.
Yes.
I wish I had tape recorded you saying that. I agree with you totally, and I get students here at Williams who come in and tell me they really want to be teachers, but their parents are so against it because they feel they sent them to a great college like Williams, and what a waste to become teachers. Your message, it's not my message, it's your message needs to go out to other parents. It's the most wonderful message. The only piece that I can think about to implement that, and that's why I have this idea of these very competitive, well-endowed programs that support teachers, is that for some of these parents, if their kid got selected for some very prestigious, you know, wonderful group, and then got a stipend for 3 years, it might shift people's perception of it. If they felt their kid was becoming part of this cohort of very talented, ambitious young teachers, that wouldn't do everything. Some of what you're talking about is a subtler shift in terms of our values and our ethos, but it might do something. After all, there are other very impressive careers that parents are very happy to have their kids go into that don't make a lot of money. That's one of the strange things about teaching. It's true that teacher salaries aren't high enough in most places, but it's not the only part of it, because after all, there are other careers. If your kid became a journalist, for instance,
that's right,
they'd probably never be rich, but we'd be proud of them. And so the question is, what money is a part of it, but what else would change our view of teaching and make it the kind of career that this phone caller is talking about?
Right.
But I totally, that's a great message.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Bob, so much for the call. Joe from Wisconsin. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Your guest. Well, my comment really has to do with the demands that are put on teachers on a daily basis and how that's just been going up and up and up. I'm a retired university professor and also taught in the public schools. My wife is a public school teacher. And it's very frustrating. She comes home to speak. She talks of how many what's expected of them on a day-to-day basis. It just increases from year to year, and their resources go down and down. It's very frustrating for her, and I think because of that, the quality of teaching, you know, has to suffer, and therefore the students suffer, and it's a frustrating thing. I think it has to do with what many of your callers have spoke of is the value that we put on teachers, and you know, at the community level, and you know, it's a very frustrating thing.
Well, I totally agree. That's why I, you know, mentioned in the column that schools have to be a place where teachers want to be and want to do their work. And, you know, that's a place where we could learn from other cultures that make the teaching day a more appealing day with more time. I mean, in Japan, historically, elementary school teachers had much more time to prepare their classes than we give our teachers. So too often we don't treat them like the high-level professionals we want them to be, and then we get what we pay for, in a sense. Some of the problems I've had, you know, I've gotten a lot of mail in the last 2 days. And,
good for you.
And, you know, but some people really like what I said, and some people really don't. And one of the issues that some teachers felt very angry about was that they felt I was blaming them and that more burden should be placed on children and their parents because kids come into school so ill-prepared for behaving well, for wanting to learn. Kids come in, they haven't eaten right. And, you know, my ideas about teachers aren't going to solve every problem that schools face. We live in a time when it's true there's terrible poverty. Many kids suffer indirectly the effects of racism, not only because of how they're treated, but because they're in schools that are inadequately funded or inadequately staffed. Jonathan Kozol has written about this, you know, very eloquently. And those are issues that fixing schools won't necessarily fix. So a wonderful school won't turn badly fed children into well-fed children. And it won't create integrated, diverse communities where people tolerate one another's differences. That has to come from other sources as well. And some of what this phone caller is talking about, I think, has to do with other problems that are very real. So for those of us interested in schools, we just have to figure out the piece we can do, which is create a school which has a good climate. And that has to do with staffing it with teachers who create a good climate in it. But it's true. It's a very demanding job, and that's all the more reason why the people who are rethinking education need to put more time and money into thinking about how to make it a good place to work, whether that means giving teachers more time to plan during the day. A lot of this, in my view, has to do with this insane testing, which places a huge administrative burden on teachers and makes their job less fun. So the weak teachers can hide under, you know, the administrative demands and the rigidity of the testing, and the good teachers, you know, are suffocated. And, you know, when I go into a school, when I started the school 14 years ago, helped start, I was just a co-founder, one of the things I thought about is when you build a school, what your job is to make it so that good teachers can do a good job and not protect bad teachers, but allow good teachers to do what they do best. And that should be on the mind of everyone who's setting up a school. And I think that speaks to the issue of making it a better place to be for teachers.
Hmm. More phone calls for Susan in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. This article caught my attention, Teachers Well, in the Monday New York Times op-ed. It's a great article by Susan, who's a senior lecturer in psychology and director of the program in teaching at Williams College. She calls for greater honoring of the profession and challenges the best universities in this country to quit looking down their noses at education. She talks about selective teacher training programs and learning what you can, your subject, that which you are passionate about, and then learning much more about development still stages of children and who children are in your graduate studies, and then a collaborative setting for you once you decide to become a teacher. It's really a stirring and intellectually challenging and interesting article. I urge you to look at it. And so that's what we're talking about this hour. She has taught all ages from three-year-olds to graduate students. And as you heard, she co-founded an experimental school some 13 years ago. She's written a number of books as well. Our number, thank you, Joe, so much for your call. We have one line open. Our lines have been very busy on this, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls. Ruth from Altoona, hi.
Yes, good morning, and I've been enjoying this program very much. Thank you. Just a comment, and I'm assuming that because, you know, you're coming from out of state, that you're not aware that Wisconsin does have a professional development process for teachers, which includes mentoring of new teachers, peer mentoring. It's called PDP, or Professional Development Plan Process. I'm not exactly sure. I don't work with it directly, but I'm aware of it. And it was established a number of years ago and looked like it was going to be a very robust program. People, you know, at first were not sure they wanted to do it, but it's won a lot of people over. It's an excellent program, but over the years, our Department of Public Instruction has been putting less and less funding underneath it. So we have in place, it does exist, it's here, it's happening, and I know locally they had a consortium of people who helped implement and develop this, including university people, local school people, you know, other specialists, teachers themselves, and then it's just become such a tiny little program because of the lack of funding for it. And then I just have one other comment, but I'll let you respond to that if you have a response.
I'm just interested and curious, why did they stop funding it?
Well, it's funded, but the funding is lower and lower and lower.
And why is that?
I imagine it's a financial issue. It's you know, I don't know who's making these decisions, but it's sad to watch it become smaller. And like I said, I'm not directly involved. I just have observed it.
No,
we should look at that.
It's a shame because it's exactly the kind of program we need more of. One of the things I've been thinking of is that, you know, if you watch in public schools, good teachers often at a certain point, they get tired of teaching. They are worn out. And then very typically what happens is they get channeled into administrative jobs, often that remove them further and further from kids. They do development of curriculum, they apply for grants, whatever they do. And it'll be really interesting, and maybe this is what the Wisconsin program is like, when wonderful teachers become, you know, they just get burned out or they get tired of classroom teaching, there should be money to pay them just to mentor younger teachers. And maybe that's what you have. If you do, and it was working well, and it's receiving less funding, I have no good comment except that's what they should be funding.
Right, I mean, right. And I just wanted to let people in the state know that this does exist, and it does deserve for parents to know about this, for other people to know that this does deserve a lot more attention than currently it's getting. And then also just a comment in terms of there's a kind of a sage, a man that I think a lot of. His name is John O'Brien, and he encourages us all to be a part of a constructive problem-solving process. So if we have concerns about something or are critical of something, that we all need to be a part of it. And his quote, although not grammatically correct, is, what if they is us? You know, what if we approach things as if, what if they, teachers, students, community, what if they is us?
That's wonderful.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call, Ruth. We'll follow through on what you've been talking about as well. Pat from Minocqua. Hi, Pat.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I have two comments. One is that if we want better teachers, and we want them to go get the education. Why couldn't we supplement their college tuition if they signed and agreed to become a teacher?
Oh, yeah. This is part of the article we haven't talked about yet.
Okay, I'm waiting to hear you two flesh out the article.
This was the part where you talk about free tuition for those who have the 3.5 undergraduate and a stipend for the first 3 years of teaching in a public school.
So, you know, I agree with the person that's calling about this or some version of it. Let me give an example just from here at Williams. We have a wonderful financial aid system. I got a few letters yesterday, you know, attacking my point because it promoted elitism. Actually, at Williams, we have a needs-blind admissions process, so anybody can apply, and if they're good enough to get in, doesn't matter what their financial situation is. But we have a needs-based financial aid approach. So once they're in, we give them the support based on, you know, what they need. And that's pretty generous and a pretty good way to make sure we have a very diverse student body. However, when they get here and they do really well, as we were saying before, as that phone caller was talking about parents think, I went through all this, you worked so hard to get in, you need to go into a profession that really can make money or that can pay back the costs involved in going to college, especially students who are first-generation students. Their parents have not gone to college or they're the first one in their family to go to college, you can understand why they shy away from pursuing a career that won't help them pay back their, you know, the cost of being educated. That's where we have to provide a financial incentive, especially during the first few years. And the irony is, you know, when our students here get into graduate school to become scientists or mathematicians, they all get financial aid. You know, when I went to graduate school, my whole graduate education was paid for by a grant from the National Institute of Child Health and Development or something. And so we think nothing as a culture of paying to train our top scholars. But we have to take a little of that thinking and apply it to teachers. Now, medical students, I don't think they get financial aid. Most of them don't get, you know, grant money or federal support for medical school costs, but they are assured they'll make enough money once they get their MD to pay back the costs of being educated. We need something comparable, either in terms of a financial aid during graduate education or the promise of money afterwards, to make this financially viable, to make it attractive to our best students.
Right. Thank you, Pat, so much for your call. We go to Andy next from Waupun. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. I'm enjoying your little talk here today. The question that I have for you is, where does online learning come into play with this? My kids are using a program called Odysseyware, and it's really amazing. I mean, it kind of fills in gaps for kids, and it's self-directed. The kids can do that. I can view that. I can view my students' work at home, and I can do these sorts of things. So in this whole process of improving education, I'm just wondering where the concept of online learning is coming into play.
Well, that's a whole other topic, and I'm not sure I'm the most qualified person to talk to you about it. One thing I do think I'm very open to and excited about the ways in which we can use the internet and email to reach out to people and to make education more accessible. On the other hand, I think it's really important that people not forget that schools are communities. And one of the most powerful parts of the educational experience is the chance for kids to be around other people that are different than they, to be around grown-ups who are not their parents, to be known and understood by people they've never met before, and to find ways to come up with common goals, common values, to tolerate one another. You know, John Dewey talked about this 100 years ago, and we still haven't really put it into practice, which is the idea that intellectual, the pursuit of knowledge, academics, is not separate from the pursuit of community and the ability to engage, embrace a multiplicity of perspectives, to live amongst other people. At its best, school provides that, provides a real community. So even if there are wonderful ways to use the internet and do online learning, either for kids in schools or for graduate school students learning to become teachers, my own sense
is that for now anyway, that can never replace the sort of living, breathing place, the real building or house or, you know, whatever it is, structure, where real people spend time together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't want to miss that, you know, and although as adults we can communicate with one another online and maybe it's the same as being in a room together, I'm not sure if it is or isn't, that's certainly not the case for four-year-olds who are very much still creatures of the body.
Dr. Engel, we have to go. Thank you. Would you join us and talk about your book sometime? You're great.
Anytime.
Thank you. You're just fabulous.
Well,
thank
it's
you.
Been great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Susan Engel, her piece is in the op-ed New York Times this Monday, November 2nd. So look it up. I think it's a very good piece. Thank you, Rob Schroeder, for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob as well for on-air production. Rob is going to the University of Chicago starting next week, so we thank him for all the work he's done the last year. We will miss him. And, you know, you can go to our website, too, to look at him and also to find out more about the work that he's done. We have a new Facebook, and go to WPR.org and get Kathleen Dunn and become a fan.